then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's January the 22nd, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I have an announcement to make, and that announcement is going to have an effect on Radio Free Northwest and the way we do the show. As of this week, we're going to be syndicated on Rodney Martin's American Nationalist Network. Radio Free Northwest will be rebroadcast every week on Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the ANA, not Pacific Time as I originally thought. I also understand that as of February, it will be called the All Nationalist Network. Now, this is a pretty big deal. We're still going to be preaching to the choir, but it's going to be the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and not just our own little circle of church ladies, so to speak. We're going to be getting thousands of new listeners, and for that reason, I am going to be taking the show back to basics for a while, in view of the fact that a large number of those new listeners will have no idea who we are, what the Northwest Novels are, or what the Northwest Imperative is. There's going to be some stuff on here that longtime listeners to the podcast will find repetitious, but which will be new to many, if not most, ANA listeners. Now, for those many listeners among you who are hearing me for the first time and have no idea who the hell I am, my name is Harold Covington, and I represent the Northwest Front. We advocate the establishment of an all-white homeland here in the Pacific Northwest, where new generations of white children can be raised in both physical and moral safety and health. I'm also the author of the 5 Northwest Independence novels, which some of you may be familiar with. And if not, you can go to our party's website at www.northwestfront.org and learn more about them in a special section there. Now, those novels are called The Hill of the Ravens, A Distant Thunder, A Mighty Fortress, The Brigade, and Freedom's Sons. If you really want to learn about the Northwest Imperative, you need to obtain and read those novels, because I say in those works of fiction things that can't be conveniently said out loud in this society. The Northwest Imperative is not new. I did not invent it, and I make no such claim. An independent white homeland in the Northwest was first advocated back in the 1970s by people like Pastor Bob Miles, Pastor Richard Butler, and of course the heroic freedom fighters of the Order. Now, if you really want to get esoteric about it, you might say that we go all the way back to the early 1800s, with the great conspiracy of Aaron Burr and General James Wilkinson to seize what was then the Louisiana Territory and make it into a new country separate from the United States. Now, wouldn't that have changed history, huh? One of the great might have beens. Or you might say that the Northwest idea goes back to the 1940s, when the people of Northern California got so sick and tired of being governed by corrupt politicians in Sacramento, who were responsive in those days only to the equally corrupt cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco, and the Jewish Empire down in Hollywood, that they got together in the first secession convention since 1861, somewhere up around Eureka, I think, and they declared Northern California to be a separate state, which they called the State of Jefferson. I guess they figured if Washington had a state named after him, so could Thomas Jefferson. They were on the verge of petitioning Congress to recognize them as a separate state when Pearl Harbor happened, and so that pretty much put paid to that. But the idea has been there for a long time. The Northwest Independence Movement is based on the immortal 14 words of David Lane: "We must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children." The Northwest Imperative has one single overriding objective: the world must change. The purpose of democracy is to prevent change. The purpose of revolution is to bring it about, and that is our purpose. I am not ruling out the possibility that one day the Northwest Front might run in elections, but it'll only be to provide a legal format for revolutionary organizing. Specifically, the Northwest Movement is based on a number of principles, all of which I believe are demonstrably true if they are approached with an open mind. Now, one of these is that the white race is faced with literal physical extinction both here and in Europe. Establishment media now admit that white people will be a minority on this continent by the year 2040, and that doesn't even take into account the problem of the age of the white population at that time. By 2040, not only will whites be in a numerical minority, but we will all be so old that it will be effectively impossible for us to regenerate ourselves and bear another complete generation. Right now, white women of childbearing age comprise only 3% of the world's population. By 2040, our racial extinction will become an accomplished fact. Now, the second basic principle of the Northwest Imperative is that the United States of America, in its present form, is doomed, and that the only way to secure the existence of our people and the future for white children is physical separation from the mud races. Now, this requires territory, land of our own, and a government of our own. This white homeland must be a sovereign and independent nation where no non-whites and no Jews and no homosexual perverts and no bird-brained liberals are even allowed to live. All those people have to be completely removed from the political and social equation. Now, when people say to me, "Oh, Harold, you're a monster, you're cruel and mean and heartless," I tell them to go take a flying leap at a rolling donut. My eyes are on the prize, folks. I want the result, an all-white world where white children don't have to go through what we've had to go through. Yes, Virginia, sometimes the end really does justify the means. And that is the case with white survival. The survival of the white race on Earth is non-negotiable. The 14 words of David Lane are non-negotiable, and we need to start manning up and doing what is necessary to make sure that there are still some people with our color skin alive on this continent in another 100 years. Now, you can't cure disease without dealing with germs and the infection they cause. Historically, human problems are very seldom caused by nature anymore. The Black Death wiped out 1/3 of Europe in the 14th century, but this isn't the 14th century anymore. Earthquakes in Haiti notwithstanding, the Western world has the science and technology now to beat famine and plague and to predict and deal with things like hurricanes and volcanoes and repair the damage they do when they occur. The white man does anyway. Black primitives in Haiti don't, but I'm not concerned with them. If global warming were real, which it's not, it wouldn't wipe us out because science, white man's science, I might add, would find a way to deal with it. No, in recent centuries, human problems have been caused mostly by people. And the only way to put a stop to some problems is to remove certain people from participation in the process of politics and life. Now, that may sound cruel and cynical, but it's true. And if you look at human history, that's more often than not how mankind solves its problems. Through proactive human intervention that one way or another removes certain groups, nations, and races from the picture. That's just the way it is. And it's not going to change because some people don't have the courage or the energy to do what is necessary to save white people from extinction. Now, there have been some white separatists who think that we should do like the Amish and just buy some land somewhere out in the boondocks and go off and live in little log cabins and be on our own and to hell with the outside world. In other words, anything so we don't have to show physical courage and confront the United States and its armed men. Well, unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. The establishment will not allow anyone to opt out of this system. Ask Randy Weaver. Ask the Branch Davidians. Ask those Mormon fundamentalists in Texas whose compound was raided some years ago and whose children have been taken away from them to be raised as brainwashed American consumer animals. It is impossible to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children without establishing our own territory, our own state, and our own government. It is impossible for white people ever to be truly free or even to survive as a race without confronting the Zionist state. Without confronting the empowered Zionist and liberal ruling elite and removing them from power. They have the power, and if we are to survive, we cannot continue to try and escape and evade and hide. We must take their power away from them and appropriate it for ourselves. In the real world, that's how it works, and we have to start living in the real world. When a man is attacking you with a gun or another weapon in his hand and trying to kill you, you may survive for a bit by running away, but if you're in a cage, even a cage as big as the United States of America, and you can't flee out of his range, then eventually that armed killer will catch up with you and find you. When a man is attacking you with a weapon in his hand, you can't just turn your back on him and ignore him and pretend he doesn't exist. hoping that he'll concentrate his murderous intentions on someone else and always pass you and your loved ones by. Tyranny needs victims. Human beings and human blood and suffering are the fodder on which tyranny feeds, whether the tyrant be Hammurabi or Genghis Khan or Stalin or Barack Hussein Obama. And you might achieve survival for a time, if not peace, through silence and submission. The monster may not bother you for a while if you're very quiet and don't attract his attention, but eventually he's going to notice you and it will be your turn. All you accomplish by turning your back on him and pretending he doesn't exist is he'll shoot you in the back. In our society, the armed homicidal maniac with a gun who's coming to kill us is the United States government. If we do not disarm this crazy man, this insane beast, then it's going to kill us all and force our children to live in a world that doesn't bear thinking about. Now, at this point, I suppose I should ask you to bear in mind that there are distinct limitations on what I can say on the air here. We always need to bear in mind that the enemy is listening. He's listening to this show, and he's monitoring every email and every phone call we make. Even if this may not be literally true all the time, we have to act as though it is true. Like Winston Smith in the George Orwell novel 1984, we have to learn to live as if we are watched every moment of our lives, from our cell phones to our chat rooms to the spy cameras in shopping malls and office buildings. And we know all this thanks to the revelations of Edward Snowden, but we knew it before the Snowden thing came along. And then we have to learn the art of ignoring the fact that we live in a goldfish bowl and continuing to function in spite of it all. Because we have to function. We dare not allow ourselves to become so terrified of FBI agents under the bed and microphones in the sugar bowl that we cannot function, because that is what they want. Constant government surveillance is a form of terrorism. The regime's secret police want us to be afraid to speak, afraid to communicate with one another, afraid to function. And we can't let them do that to us. We just need to develop a level of care about what we say that becomes almost instinctive. In keeping with that, I think we all realize that there are parameters to what I can say here. Very often I'll have to resort to what Lenin referred to as Aesopian language, the language of fable. I will have to follow the late Pastor Bob Miles's dictum about never committing to paper anything you wouldn't want read out in open court, or in this case, never saying anything on the air that I wouldn't want played back in open court, as someday, no doubt it will be. If at times on this show I seem to be dancing around something, beating around the bush, or going around my elbow to get to my thumb in order to make a point, then you're just going to have to learn to read between the lines. I just remember what I said about that crazy man with the gun from Washington, D.C. who's coming to kill us all. You can't run and hide from him forever, and you can't just pretend he doesn't exist. On his part, the man in the silk suit or the woman in her pants suit with their government-issue gun in a shoulder holster can't be merciful. They can't just decide to let us alone any more than we can ignore them, because they have no will of their own, because it's not up to them. They have to do what the computer tells them to do, because they've sold their soul for a direct deposit every month, and, to be fair, also for medical and health insurance for their families, which is almost unobtainable now in any decent form. Putting on that federal badge is a form of resignation from the human race. A federal agent made the decision long ago to trade his or her integrity, their free will, and their soul in exchange for the material benefits that the regime provides. And they have become so morally corrupted that they are no longer amenable to reason or human decency. Don't believe it? Got two words for you, Edgar Steele. A federal agent's entire reason for being is specifically to do us harm. Sooner or later, one way or the other, we're all going to have to deal with these people, and I think it's best that we do so acting together and with a plan. We as a people are caged by what is. But we must learn to see beyond the bars. Okay, this is one of our comrades that we call the trucker because, well, he's a trucker. He sends in little titbits from all over the road talking about conditions out there in America's heartland and why you should migrate to the Northwest.
Westbound and down, 18-wheels are rolling. Are we going to do what they say can be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, some never mind the brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we gotta run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Kentucky. I got a nice New Year's Eve present yesterday, because this is New Year's morning. Just got done listening to today's podcast, or this week's podcast, and I no longer have to go to Queens. A driver that lives up in Connecticut gets to deliver that load, so I'm on my way to Texas again. But this is about financing, or finances. Back when I was a young wee little lad and stuff, my parents, I remember probably about 6 or 8 years old, something like that, they had their mortgage burning party. And they had the house, they only had about maybe 8 or 10 years, they had the mortgage paid off. Didn't finance cars. Yeah, I'm sure they had a few credit cards, but they kept them paid off. I was stupid, didn't follow the example, and got into the credit circle. And just think of how much better off you'd be, especially, this is for you young folks, don't get into the credit card thing. Don't end up paying interest like 20, 25, 30% or whatever the hell the credit cards are charging nowadays, because I do not have a credit card. Yes, I have a debit card, and paycheck goes into the account that way, so we can go and pull money out. But got house paid off, got no car payments, so if we can't afford to pay for it in cash, we just go and save up and get it when we have the money. So try to stay out of the credit circle. Not sure what your feelings are on Dave Ramsey, or if you've even heard of him. He has a pretty good plan, the envelope system, and you need to get yourself a budget and stick with it. Put money into savings, and that way you can have money for your move up here to the Northwest. Yep, don't mean to preach too much about it, but it's a lot better off if you don't owe money to the credit unions, or the credit institutions, and try to stay away from lease programs. Oh God, we ended up financed our first few vehicles, and it was like the most you could go and finance them for was 4 years, and it was only less than $200 a month for the vehicle payment. But nowadays, you're looking at what, I haven't really paid much attention, but it's like, $400 or $500 a month for a lease payment, and then you've got the balloon at the end. Oh, please, no. And then at the end of the lease, if you go over on your mileage, oh, then you get dinged there too. So, yep, my advice is go and look around and find a good used car and try to keep it up in good shape so you can stay out of the debt circle, the dreaded debt circle. Yeah, don't get into that, please. And if you are into it, hopefully you're not into it very deeply. Just try to stay out of that. If you end up had purchased a home and stuff, I hope you're not too far underwater. Try to get it fixed up, get it on the market, get it sold, and get your assets up here to the homeland. It would be nice to give the U-Haul company a nice big headache where they have a glut of U-Haul vehicles, be it trucks or trailers or a combination of both, up here in the homeland, where they have to go and redistribute them back to other parts of the country. So all the rest of you comrades can be able to rent them and move your assets up here. So that's a good New Year's plan for you. Get your ass up here to the Northwest. This is the trucker signing off for another Tidbits on the Road.
Okay, time for first music break. This is one of those voices that let you know that there is indeed a God. This is Lorena McKennitt. In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. I might point out here that neither of the women who were Steele's purported victims ever believed him to be guilty of this charge, and both supported him publicly, Cindy's mother until her own death from natural causes and Cindy herself to this day. The alleged would-be assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who was inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family, until, for reasons as yet unclear, Fairfax's mission ceased to become one of mere intelligence gathering and became one of perjury and personal destruction. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend a few months in county jail and then under house arrest with an ankle bracelet in the service of the Bureau. A short time after her husband was arrested, Edgar's wife Cindy pulled into a local service station for an oil change, and the mechanic found a bomb wired to the underside of her car. Not knowing that the bomb was part of an FBI fabrication against her husband, the local police called a rival federal agency, the BATFE, who refused to honor the FBI's assurance that Larry Fairfax was one of their CIs and proceeded to arrest and charge Fairfax publicly for manufacturing and transporting the explosive device, much to the Bureau's extreme embarrassment. The bomb was clearly intended to go off and kill Cindy in order to bolster the Bureau's case against Edgar, and also remove a potential fly in the ointment, since Cindy was already balking at the official version of events and refusing to go along and play the victim. Now the dictatorship faced the additional complication and embarrassment of having their informer publicly exposed by the ATF, who refused to carry the FBI's water on this one. Fairfax's role in the case was eventually laughed off by the courts with a 27-month sentence, none of it in actual prison. Fairfax was moved from county jail to house arrest 5 months after Edgar Steele was sentenced to 50 years. Today he's a free man with a nice chunk of change in his pocket, some of it from the silver he stole from Edgar Steele. The trial of Edgar Steele in 2011 was an unmitigated horror show. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction was audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These conversations appear, even to a layman who first hears them, to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to state categorically, for the record, that the tapes were fraudulent, were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Now, many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the dictatorship to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. The dictator's servants broke their word, surprise, surprise. In September of 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud. I suppose there's some comfort in hoping that the bent brief will possibly die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. Interestingly enough, McAllister himself was a former United States attorney and prosecutor, which gives you some idea of the typical moral character of the people involved in the federal judiciary. For whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. Apparently, something even worse was happening, though. Now, I was not able to attend the trial myself, but I've spoken to persons who were present in the courtroom who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie during the trial, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion among those who actually saw him on those days was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. On May the 5th, absent the expert testimony that could have proven his innocence, Edgar Steele was found guilty of 4 criminal charges against him. He was eventually sentenced to 50 years. Being 66 years old at the time, it was understood by all that this was a death sentence. The United States penal system maintains several special medical and geriatric units at places like Springfield, Missouri, and Fort Devens, Massachusetts, to care for federal prisoners who are extremely sick or elderly, but who caught one of those absurd 990-year sentences and who will never be released. In view of his age and the perilous state of his health, Edgar Steele should have been sent to one of these. Instead, he was sent to the heavily fortified, maximum-security Victorville facility in California, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele was sent there to die, and on September the 4th, 2014, he did. On or about that day, Edgar J. Steele was murdered in horrific circumstances which I described in a podcast at the time and which I do not intend to go over again here. I said pretty much all I had to say at that time, but I do not intend to let the dictatorship bury Edgar's memory, and so from now on there will be periodic reminders on Radio Free Northwest that once there was a man who stood up for his people and his country and paid the ultimate price for it. Now I'm going to have to ask for the indulgence of our 5,000 or so regular Radio Free Northwest listeners. In my Edgar Steele segment of last week, I played the beginning of Ed's famous essay on anti-Semitism. It's a long podcast, and I had to cut it in half for two successive shows. Now, last week, though, I didn't know that this week we would be at least doubling our listenership with thousands of new people who've never heard this show before. I was going to play the second part of Edgar J. Steele's On Anti-Semitism this week, but that simply wouldn't make sense for all these new listeners to start in the middle of a speech without hearing the first part. Accordingly, for our new ANN audience, I'm going to replay the first segment of that cast by the late Edgar J. Steele, the one I played last week. I know many of you heard it before, and although like all Ed's stuff, I think it's good enough to listen to twice, if you heard it last week, you probably want to fast forward to second music break right about now.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's April 17, 2008, and today's piece is entitled In Defense of Anti-Semitism, Reloaded. I really need to update and reissue more of my older pieces than I've been doing. Readers often point out something I wrote years ago, causing me to ferret it out of my archives myself and read it again with fresh eyes, as though reading somebody else's work for the first time. If it seems fresh and worthwhile to me, I figure, it'll be even fresher to those who never had a chance to read it in the first place. Besides, it amazes me how well so much has stood up over time. Take today's piece, which I wrote over 5 years ago, just before America lurched into Iraq. Our posture was much as it is today, on the verge of shelling Iran. I was tempted to update this article completely, but resisted that urge. There's a good deal to be learned from a historical perspective, even one so recent as exhibited herein. Perhaps this will do some good regarding our impending misadventure in Iran. Listen with me now, as I hold forth, yet again, on the root cause of American problems. Originally, I wanted to call this Why I Am an Anti-Semite. It's telling indeed that even I finally knuckled under and chose a less sensational title. The silence in America concerning Jews is simply deafening, isn't it? The old adage has it that when visiting a foreign country to ascertain who really runs things, one need determine only who is spoken about in whispers, if at all. Never unwilling to offend, I would like to talk about Jews today. And not in whispers, either. This piece will be longer than most I write, even though I will only be skimming the field. A good deal of ground must be covered, else the true picture does not emerge. What gets lost in all the saber-rattling and bellicosity concerning Iraq is the why of the impending war. Because the Iraqis hate our freedom? No, obviously not. Because they are too evil to exist? Come on. Because they have used awful weapons, still possess them, and will use them again? Give me a break. On the basis of that rationale, we should be marching on every member of NATO. The Muslims are right, you know. This is a war against Islam. Pure and simple. Not Christianity versus Islam. Not the West versus Islam. Not America versus Islam. This is a war between Judaism and Islam. Palestine writ large. Not a religious war either, despite the rhetoric of the Arabs. It is a racial war, and Americans are the cannon fodder. But Israel is our friend, you say. The best friend we have in that hostile quarter of the world. Our only friend, more like it. Israel is our friend so long as we serve its purposes. Indeed, friend is too kind a word. Svengali is more like it. Proof abounds of Israel acting against America's interests at every turn, many of which we will review today. No, Israel does not run America, but the shadowy cartel that does run America is solidly behind Israel. Israel is that cartel's mistress. America, its dowdy wife. No, not every member of that cartel is Jewish, but so many are that it might as well be exclusive. There was a time in the not-too-distant past when I thought that Jewishness was religious and cultural, possibly racial too, but so what? After all, American Jews are generally well-off, well-educated, well-spoken, a little clannish, and well-connected. Just like you and me, only better dressed and with trust fund. Like rich Mormons, maybe. It's an outlook shared by most Americans. It is wrong. This common misperception will prove fatal to America, just as it has to so many nations down through time. This is where I'm supposed to utter the obligatory, "I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm really just anti-Zionist." Well, that's a cop-out, and I refuse to do it, even though strictly true. I'm appalled that all Jews allow the Zionists among them to fall back into their ranks, hiding behind their Jewishness, while hurling charges of anti-Semitism at those they dislike. And their fellow Jews don't say a word about it. In the law, we call that a conspiracy, and we lock up the co-conspirators just like the perps. Okay, I'll play. I'm anti-Semitic. So what? Do you really blame me after all that you have done to me, my family, and my country, nay, the world? Let's get the terms straight. Joe Sabran really is right on the money regarding anti-Semite, first of all, when he says that it used to be defined as being somebody who hates Jews, but now it means a man who is hated by Jews. Ultimately, an anti-Semite is whatever a Jew says, whoever a Jew dislikes. And, ultimately, Jews seem to dislike everybody else. In fact, I've seen Jews acknowledge that everybody who isn't a Jew is, by definition, anti-Semitic, kind of like the rationale underlying hate crime laws, which are only applied against white people because all white people are deemed racist, per se. Jew. It's a race, not a religion. Facts are fact. The majority of Israelis are atheist. At this moment, Jews are doggedly trying to craft a deadly virus that will select people, such as Arabs, for their DNA differences from Jewish DNA. And I don't want to hear all this buzz about Khazar versus Sephardic Jews or who deserves to claim to be descended from the biblical family of Abraham. There is a group of people scattered throughout the world that calls itself Jewish. We all know who they are, just as do they. They are racially identifiable, even if of two or three flavors. They get the label Jew, and that is reality, history aside. Zionist used to mean those who work toward the establishment of a Jewish homeland. Now it means Jewish supremacist, pure and simple, kind of like white supremacist, only kosher. Zionists are the real problem, and they are found among the ranks of Jews everywhere. They are the ones that always cross the line and get the whole lot of them thrown out of the country. You don't believe this? Okay, then you offer a single logical reason why it has happened time and again in all the European countries. Zionism is racism of the first order. Yes, Jews do get persecuted. What gets overlooked is the reason, kind of like focusing on the rights of the murderer and not his victim. No, not kind of. That's exactly what it is.
Oi! Foist Egypt! Den join any! Out here! What? Why are they persecuting us so?
Trust me. They know precisely why. Generally, it appears to me that someone has to have had a trigger event of some sort happen to themselves or someone close to them before that person is willing to see Jews as predatory. A trigger event wherein a Jew played the role of the victimizer. Like how being raped will make any woman a rabid defender of the Second Amendment. Without a trigger event, people generally are willing to dismiss those who speak out as being nut, racist, and white supremacists. Like saying, the raped woman was asking for it. That's how that treatment feels, believe me. My trigger event actually was two. First, when a lawyer that I hired, hoping that he would work hard and eventually take over my thriving San Francisco law practice, allowing me to retire, tried to steal all my firm's clients, work in progress, and employees, leaving me with nothing. This after only a couple months on the job, too. Jewish, of course. Most lawyers are, you know. Though the sledding was tough with this guy due to the Jewish judges, eventually I eviscerated him financially, and with the help of a black judge at that. Second, and this was the really key event for me, when my children received death threats from a Jewish telephone caller, merely because I had dared to represent Richard Butler and the Aryan Nations against a set of false charges. There have been lots of other events since then, but I will never forget the look in my little girl's tear-filled eyes as she told me about the woman who was going to kill her. Watching one's family butchered will make a terrorist of anyone. Just ask the Palestinians. Similarly, watching your family terrorized by Zionists will make you anti-Semitic in a heartbeat. Take it from me.
I play music on here basically to break up the monotony of droning voices, including my own, but also to give our listeners a feel for white history and heritage and culture, especially younger people who have never been allowed to learn who they are and who have never heard much of this. The music I play on here varies, but one of my favorite kinds is new racial music written and sung by actual white nationalist performers, and there's beginning to be a lot more of that than just skinhead rock music. This is a British comrade called Arlen Bran, which isn't his real name, of course. Not so surprising, since singing this song and recording it could get him 7 years in prison in his own land. This is called Ancestors.
Chinese woman, this is not your country. Indian man, this is not your land. This is my country and this is my land. Neolithic chamber raised by ancestors' hands. Pakistani boy, you don't belong here. Nigerian girl, it's time to go home. This is my country and this is my land. Neolithic chamber raised by ancestors' hands. A whiter, brighter future. A whiter, brighter future. A whiter, brighter future. A whiter, brighter future. This is my country and this is my land. My ancestors' bones lay buried in this sand. To take action, the white community standing proud and strong. This is my country and this is my land. Neolithic chamber raised by ancestors' hands. A whiter, brighter future. A whiter, brighter future. A whiter, brighter future. A whiter, brighter future.
Okay, next up is a lady we call Gretchen the Librarian. We call her that because she really is a librarian from a little town in New England. Kind of our own Emily Dickinson. Now, she does mostly book reviews on all kinds of deep philosophical white nationalist authors, many of whom even I've never heard of, but her reviews are one way that we keep current on what's going on in our spiritual and ideological world, and yes, our movement does have one. Okay, now, Gretchen is admittedly kind of an acquired taste, and some people find her book reviews a little dry and esoteric, but I like them. I think they fulfill a need for balance in the show, and also, I'll be honest with you, I think it's important that we have a female voice on here regularly. I always try to include as many women as possible, and I always encourage our female comrades to contribute. Anyway, see what you think.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to talk about why we fight. This is a manifesto slash dictionary written by Galami Fay. This was actually written back in 2000. It's one of those books that I always meant to review, so I'm finally getting around to it. Now, I understand that we have some new listeners tonight, so I just want to welcome you to our show. Typically, I do book reviews. Tonight, of course, I'm doing Why We Fight. This starts out by saying that the identitarian movement, this is a term that they have in France and maybe in other parts of Europe, is the sole authentic, rebellious, and dissident form of thought, at least in today's world. This manifesto is reminding us to beware of cooperation with the system, but also with those posing as defenders of identity, such as pseudo-pagans. I guess the best example I can think of to illustrate this would be something like Universalist Ozotro. And also, Galami is telling us to beware of those who seem against the system, but only attack the superficials. He talks about how waysides can be either intellectual, spiritual, such as getting caught up in philosophy. And, for instance, this author is a fan of Evola. And I will be talking about, probably at some point, one of Julius Evola's books. I'll be talking about The Metaphysics of War at some point. So we can get caught up in the philosophical, or we can get caught up in a political career. And that's also problematic, and maybe even worse, because that might suck a person into the mainstream. This author is going through primarily definitions of terms and talks about how the sacred is an inner collective of motivation for a people. And right now, Europe is without this inner motivation, while Islam has one. And that's why Islam is so difficult to deal with. And the author talks about this idea of a born leader, and that's someone who breaks the system while preserving the soul of society for the future. To Faye, principal enemy is the global south. Now, you'll see that term in some European literature. They'll talk about the south. And as an American, it can be rather odd because we're so used to that reference to the American south. But of course, they're talking about the global south and primarily the south of Europe. Even though the principal enemy is to Faye is Islam, and really the global south more generally that's kind of pouring into Europe right now, to Faye, the principal adversary is the U.S. Now, to Faye, and this seems to be a European viewpoint, the United States is seen as wanting to Islamify Europe, and perhaps that's to keep Europe rather subservient. Now, this author is, of course, looking forward to this concept of Euro-Siberia and this alliance of Western Europe with Russia and other Slavics. The whole strategy for this is, well, on one hand, it's the reunification of all Indo-European peoples. It's also this notion of getting at the vast resources that are in Russia, because he wants Euro-Siberia to be this hyperpower that does not threaten anyone, but is also not threatened by anyone. And he wants Euro-Siberia to ally with China and India as essentially a bulwark against Islam and, in a larger sense, the global south. Now, of course, he wants Euro-Siberia to come about because in the future we're going to be dealing with these large blocks, these geopolitical blocks. Guillaume wants Europe to have a chance to be a large bloc because he's really concerned for Europe being completely overrun, not only completely powerless and prostrate, but really overrun, and is really fearful for the bio-integrity of Europe. Now, as such, he is, to a certain degree, an enthusiast for eugenics, and he's even willing to use artificial means for this. Now, of course, this would be ideally, in his view, this would be eugenics submitted to the sovereign project of Euro-Siberia. He understands that this will be the death of anthrocentrism and also any notion of metaphysical deism. There are some in the movement who, or at the periphery of the movement, who are against this, but Guillaume Faye is a pragmatist. Up against this restoration of order or this resurgence of Europe, Americans will eventually come crawling back asking for forgiveness. Now, part of this attitude may be, again, the fact that this was written during the Serbian War, but in part it's also a different perspective on Islam and on America and its influence in the world. I think most Americans wouldn't necessarily feel that we're pushing the Islamitization of Europe, but apparently the Europeans, or at least the French, feel that way. The author talks about how we're really not fighting for an idea, but we're fighting with ideas. Now, this book is best read as an accompaniment to Anacrofuturism by the same author. It's also going to be similar to Convergence of Catastrophes, again, by Guillaume Faye. Now, in the introduction, you'll read about how Faye has disagreements with Benoist, who is another European thinker along these lines. And it also mentions that there are some rightists who have, or quote-unquote rightists or new culturalists within Europe, who have looked at tradition-minded Islam and have seen it as another element that is fighting the system. And thus they might feel somewhat more sympathetic towards it. However, even in this case, it is still very hard to argue with Faye in terms of his hope for Euro-Siberia. Now, this is a book that you can find on Countercurrents. You can find it at, of course, Amazon. While you will find to a certain degree, as I've said, some redundancy. You're also going to find a very valuable dictionary of terms that you can keep as a reference book. So I hope you enjoyed my review. And again, I welcome our new listeners. And so thank you for listening. And I'll be back as often as possible with hopefully some very interesting and informative book reviews. So good night and hail victory, comrades.
Speaking of white nationalist singers, here's Saga. Okay, with some reluctance, I'm going to cut this short now because I'm not sure of Mr. Martin's time constraints on American Nationalist Network, and my understanding is that for his purposes, I need to keep these shows as close to 1 hour as I can from now on. Now, as you guys who listen to the podcast off the NorthwestFront.org website know, I have a tendency to run over an hour and 8 minutes, an hour and 12 minutes, so forth and so on. And it's all good as long as I can keep it under an hour and 20 minutes so the show can be transferred to a commercially available blank CD. But that might not fit into Mr. Martin's schedule. I'll check with him on that. If you would like a packet of introductory literature from the Northwest Front, including a copy of our party manual, which is called the White Book, you should contact me at nwnet@earthlink.net. That's nwnet@earthlink.net, and I'll get you one in the mail. I will need a valid name and mailing address for that. I'll also be happy to send you, for free, either the White Book or any and all of the Northwest novels in PDF format. That's if you don't mind reading a big, thick book on your computer screen. A lot of my friends and comrades get upset when I give my work away for free, but these novels were not written in order to make money. They were written in order to change the world, and that means the first priority is that they have to be read. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.